Welcome and thank you very much for joining us on episode 123 of the Blazers Edge podcast, presented to you today by BlazersEdge.com. I'm your weekend host, Chris Lucia.
And I'm your weekend co-host, Brandon Goldner. You can reach out to us via email at blazersedgepodcast@gmail.com. You can always check us out on iTunes, Stitcher, and on YouTube now. Please give us a subscription and a rating if you could. That would be awesome.
Joining us today on the Blazers Edge Weekend Podcast is former Blazers Edge editor and current SI.com writer, Ben Golliver. Ben, thanks for coming on the show today.
My pleasure. I thought you guys would never ask. I've been sitting around waiting for 2 years to get on this thing, and it's about time.
I know. It's been a while, man. Well, we're happy to have you here. We got plenty to talk about in terms of your history with the Blazers Edge, what it's been like for you covering the NBA for all these years. But first, I want to talk a little bit about, kind of the team itself, some of the individual players, and kind of, how someone who's covering the NBA from a national perspective kind of views how these guys fit into the conversation. So I guess we also have a couple Blazers Edge user questions that we'll hopefully try to get to at some point in the podcast. But I want to start out by picking your brain by, some of the current storylines that are going on with the Blazers and how they relate to the NBA. So I guess starting out, CJ McCollum, last year in the playoffs against the Grizzlies, he kind of, showed a little bit of what he could do. He got Blazer fans really excited this summer. And from a Blazer fan standpoint, Brandon and I are in this little bubble here. So we're stoked on CJ McCollum. We're absolutely excited about him. I can't wait to see what he does next. From a national writer's perspective, if you're looking at CJ McCollum, and also from someone who covered the Blazers for so many years, is this something that you kind of, when he was a scrawny rookie in 2013, coming off the ankle injury, did you see him eventually becoming the 20-point-per-game scorer that he is today for the Blazers?
It was a foot, right? I mean, wasn't it like a second foot injury? And so that was the big concern, was like, is this guy ever going to be able to stay healthy? Because those feet injuries or whatever it was, I think it was a stress fracture or something like that, was pretty terrifying. I remember pretty distinctly the buzz when he was first coming back, like how excited people were to get this lottery pick back in the lineup. And I also remember being like, what does this guy really do? Right off the bat, he wasn't really doing too much. And there's been some reporting over these last few months where it's like, maybe he didn't feel, there was some veteran sort of maybe kind of hanging over him or in his way a little bit. And he maybe might be the biggest beneficiary right up there with Damian Lillard in terms of the guys who benefited from the kind of the house cleaning last summer of all those other guys taking big minutes and huge shot totals kind of exiting. And now he's able to kind of step up a little bit. But also I think that's a psychological thing too. It's something I see with like Harrison Barnes on the Warriors right now. I mean, when you have it in your head that you're the number four guy in a given lineup, or if you're CJ McCollum and you're just trying to play around people earlier in your career, you're not going to play your own style. You're not going to do what you do best because you're constantly thinking, am I doing too much? And this is stuff like, even if you play pickup ball with guys, if you start to think like, this guy's better than me, it will get in your head too. And so I think that's really where he was early in his career. And there was a slow kind of progression. To me, let's look at this season. I mean, I think this is basically the best case scenario for him for this season. I think he's pretty much hit peak what he can do in his first year, getting big usage. I think the pairing with him and Damian Lillard, I'm higher on that than most people are. I like the idea of always having one of them on the court. I'm a big kind of proponent of that kind of staggering. I think that really gives you the ability to make the most of both their skills as sort of, guys with the ball in their hands. I understand the concerns people have playing them together, but it doesn't bother me as much, I think, in this particular team context as it might in theory, just because I look at the rest of the roster when I'm going down, like who are the known quantities, who are these big time impact players on this roster? And I'm seeing lots of question marks. And so it's almost like, look, you've got a lot of other things to complain about with where this roster is at. Why are you going to pick on the two known quantity guys who are bringing in on a night-to-night basis? So I guess in general, I didn't necessarily expect him to be this good this season. You knew there was going to be some breakouts, no question about it, you know, up and down the roster. But it almost seems like everything that people hoped for from Vonleh and then they hoped for from Myers Leonard all got like crammed into CJ's box. And like he took all of that potential and realized it by himself. So kudos to him. I mean, it's going to pay off. He's going to get paid out of this world as soon as he can, you know, negotiate his next contract. And I think it gives them a nice base going forward, you know, with those two guards. But they got some work to do around those guys.
Well, it's, I mean, you said that a lot of people question whether the Blazers can keep both Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum as their backcourt. And I think a lot of those questions tend to revolve around their defense. I'm just curious. I mean, obviously this is the first year that he has gotten starters minutes. It's a new team. Do you think that his defense is going to come along as he understands the game better, or do you think that he's limited somewhat by his physical capabilities? He's not the biggest two guard, but I'm just curious what you think about that, if he's going to develop into a better defender, if it's something he's kind of maxed out already.
I mean, these guys don't guard anybody, do they? Let's be honest. I mean, no, it's not just unique to him, and I don't think it's unique to Damian. I think you can get by with two offense-first guards, even if they're undersized like this, if you have the right supporting pieces. I mean, if you've got, you know, a guy like Aminu, obviously is defense-first, and if you had a four and a five that were legit, like, above-average quality defenders for their positions, I think that mix can work. I mean, you don't have to have five lockdown defenders. But the other thing I would say is let's not write off any player's potential for development. I mean, if you go back and look at where Steph Curry was defensively at 24, 25 to where he is now, and I don't know if you guys saw that Warriors-Clippers game. He had Chris Paul in a freaking straitjacket. I mean, and this is shocking. Like if you even just went back 3 years ago and you told Warriors fans, not only is Steph Curry going to be the greatest shooter of all time and completely blow away all these efficiency records, but he's going to be able to lock up Chris Paul to the point where he's stripping him in the open court and taking it off in transition. Those Warriors fans would have been like, even the hardcore Steph Curry fans would have been like, really? Are you serious? Like, how is this going to happen? So, you know, these guys got to do a better job. It's the same old thing. I mean, fight through the picks better, play bigger than your size. You know, I think there's been, you know, some situations where, you know, if they get into like low post situations, one-on-one, you know, they're at least competing. I mean, that's good to see. But they got to do better. I mean, they got to improve. The numbers say they're bad. The team defensive numbers say, especially lately, have been pretty ugly. And if you want to compete with the top tier in the Western Conference, you got to be balanced, you know? And I think even guys like Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook, who came in the league, they're offense first players. They both evolved into better, you know, two-way type impact guys. You know, Russ is a little bit wild for my taste, but, you know, he can do that. I think KD is a really underrated defender. So if you want to play around with, you know, the Warriors and the Spurs and, you know, the Thunder of the world, your star players have got to play defense. They got to be impact defensive players. They can't just be impact offensive players.
Is it fair to say that CJ McCollum at this point, the most improved player award for the NBA this year, that's pretty much his to lose at this point? Is that fair to say, or are there any other players who are going to provide him any competition for that award this spring?
I think of all of the Blazers that get mentioned for the awards, whether it's McCollum for most improved, whether it's Terry Stotts for coach of the year, or Neil O'Shea in the executive of the year conversation, and just kind of like write down the list, I think the one that has the most likely chance of happening is CJ McCollum for most improved. And I expect him to win it. I think it's just the easiest, cleanest case. You know, stepping into a changing environment, your numbers go way up. You're scoring 20-plus points a game, but you've got the efficiency numbers to back it up, too. I think that is really what appeals to a stat guy like myself. You know, if you just throw, you know, Monta Ellis out there, or you just throw some of these guys out there and say, hey, guess what? I know you didn't really get to touch the ball last year, but we're going to give you 18 shots a night. Like, go freaking nuts with it. I mean, what are their shooting percentages going to look like in those situations? And, you know, he's done a pretty good job of maintaining that steadiness and doing it for an offense that's performing. You know, he's playing a key role. I mean, he's driving a pretty efficient offense. He's helping Lillard drive that offense. So to me, you know, that's a pretty strong case to make despite the defensive questions. I'm not even sure really right now who the other – I guess another guy to consider would be Andre Drummond. You know, I think he's got a similar story because their team has drastically improved. They were stuck in a rut for a long time. I think, you know, him evolving into that night in, night out center where he is kind of a focal point of the offense and leading an improved defense. Plus, he's played huge minutes for them, and he stayed healthy, and I don't think he's missed a game yet this season. He makes his first All-Star team. I mean, there's a lot of most improved kind of things around Andre Drummond, so I think maybe that would be CJ's top competition. But I think it's going to be one of those two guys.
Well, I mean, I think earlier in the season, some people were saying Steph Curry, he's cooled off a little bit since then. I mean, how insane would it be to have a repeat MVP who also in that second year gets most improved? That would be nuts. But I mean, just to go back to something that you said about CJ McCollum getting more minutes, it's funny because some people, when they look at the most improved player award, they just say, oh, well, you know, it's because CJ McCollum's getting more minutes. That's the only reason why he's getting more points. And like, and it's so funny because you look around the league and like, how many cases do you see where players get more minutes and their efficiency either stays the same or goes up and they're scoring way more? Because I mean, part of it is you can surprise people, I think, 5, 6, 7 games at a time. You come out, you're super hot, and as teams start to adjust to you and they know kind of what your tendencies are and how you play, you expect to see that kind of dip back down a little bit. So I would have expected to see CJ McCollum's, you know, scoring output, just to use just a basic stat, maybe start dipping down as the season goes on. It seems like he's gotten better. I mean, is that the same thing that you've been seeing too? I mean, even with the added attention, it seems like he's gotten better as the year's gone on.
I mean, to me, it's not going to be a question of whether the volume goes up or down. It's going to be whether the efficiency starts to take a hit once you've gone through all the scouting process for the first 30 games of the season. So every team's seen you, they know what you like to do, they know where you're trying to go with your shot. And so, I mean, that's really the test, is like, do you go from a 40% three-point shooter to a 27% three-point shooter in the second half of the season once everybody figures out what you're trying to do? You know, are you able to still get to the free throw line? You know, are you still able to score in pick and roll situations? And I think what I kind of expected to see this year was that, you know, people would really kind of gang up on both Lillard and McCollum. And frankly, like, these guys are lucky that there's no hand checking and all that too, because, you know, their numbers would look a lot different in that era compared to now. But at the same time, Blazers fans are lucky that they're playing right now, because this is what's in vogue, and they're sort of on the cutting edge in terms of stylistically, like, what's going to be successful from guards. So, you know, to me, I'm not sure anybody's really totally figured them out. I think in a 7-game series, they probably wouldn't be scoring as efficiently as they are right now, but you can say that about a lot of players. It's the same thing that we say about the Raptors guards, you know, Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan. I mean, these guys put up all-star numbers every single year they get in the postseason. They look like different players once you're really able to focus in on them and take things away. But, you know, I think maybe what you're trying to get at is that the consistency aspect of CJ's season is another strong reason why he should be a most improved player candidate. And I think that's totally true.
Man, I think Cool Breeze deserves a mention there too. I mean, I guess
no.
not in terms of the NBA's most improved player, but on the Blazers, man, like, the improvement that we've seen from Allen Crabbe year to year. I mean, his first two seasons barely playing at all, and now, you know, oftentimes he's the third scorer on that team for the Blazers. So I guess I want to throw in a question about Cool Breeze here. Is this something, you know, when you were watching him, did he have all the tools when you were covering the Blazers closely? When you saw him as a second round rookie, did you see all the physical tools, the shooting stroke, the mental aspect of the game? Did you see him have all those things? And is it surprising to you that he's been able to put it together so well this year?
Well, he was a guy when they drafted him where you kind of questioned the fit, because he was in that NBA ready, quote unquote, age-wise, and with his accomplishments in college. So you kind of felt like this is the kind of guy who would go to a lottery team and then basically be like the 6th or 7th guy and then, you know, work his way up from there. And instead he goes to this sort of like veteran dominated team and basically just doesn't even play. And like, so you kind of wonder, like, what are they thinking here? But I guess it was a pretty long-term play. I think the biggest thing you've got to give him credit for is his patience, you know? Because I think in certain situations, and maybe that's credit to the organizational culture too, with what the Blazers were able to do in terms of balancing, you know, having a playoff roster that's dominated by veterans, but then also cultivating some of these younger players on the back end of their rotation. Because some guys are not going to just sit for 2 years, you know, and not make a fuss about it. I mean, you guys remember Jared Bayless? You know, yeah. That guy was not long on patience. So, you know, it really comes down to personality a little bit in terms of, are you willing to not only put in the work to develop your game, but then not get to show it off, you know, and have everybody basically forget about you and fall off the map completely because, you know, you're playing for a contract too, you know, just like everybody else on this Blazers roster. I mean, most of these guys are trying to get paid. So I think I don't necessarily see him as like this gigantic breakout guy. I mean, clearly his numbers are way up, but he's gotten a lot more minutes. And he doesn't really have the pressure on him. You know, it's sort of like, well, you know, if he faltered, you know, what would be different with the Blazers? I mean, you know, okay, a few wins here and there maybe, but it's not like he's like the main guy. Like if CJ had a bad season this year, you know, the Blazers would be in a very different place standings-wise. Like he's still a complimentary guy to what they're trying to do. So I think that also helps kind of his development too. It's almost like a soft launch, right? Like he got the very slow build-up, and now he's at a point where, okay, we need you, but we're not totally dependent on you, or we're going to like overwhelm you with responsibilities. So that's kind of what you like to see from a player who, you know, is a second round pick and not necessarily expected to be this, you know, franchise savior.
Are you saying he's not Torian Green? Like he's not going to win the Blazers 5 games this year?
Yeah, no, I mean, well, what's funny though is that some of these guys, like, when you go back and like think about like the hype or like the amount of conversation they generated when they were drafted, like he's already done more than Nolan Smith. I mean, remember Nolan Smith?
Easy.
And so it's like, God, man, you think about some of these situations, but I guess, you know, how much do you think Crab's going to get paid quite a bit this summer, don't you think?
Oh, but yeah, see, that's kind of what I was going to throw to you because, you know, Cool Breeze is kind of like he's one of the favorites of the Blazers Edge podcast. We talk about this guy all the time and we've talked about him, you know, over the last several months. And we're talking about a guy who's, you know, what, 6'6". He's a decent defender. He's a good spot up shooter. He's got a great 3-point shot. I mean, 3-and-D wings in this league, if they're capable on the defensive end of the floor, I mean, they're somewhat scarce. And guys like that coming up in a summer like this with the salary cap doing what it's going to do, I can see a guy like Allen Crabbe. I think the low end is going to be $8 million a year. I'd be surprised if he wasn't approaching $10 million a year.
I was going to start it at about 10. And I think, you know, if you're in a situation, this goes for every player, like every team, whatever you think a guy is going to make, just multiply it by 1.3. Because that's probably going to be closer to like the basement of what he's going to get this summer. You know, there's going to be exceptions, you know, guys who are going to get max deals. I mean, you already know what they're going to make. And there's going to be some guys who maybe they just fall out of favor. Like, you know, Roy Hibbert might be passing, you know, he might be on Santa Monica Boulevard passing a hat trying to get money. You know, very, very possible. So there's going to be some of those situations. But yeah, if you're kind of this en vogue 3-and-D guy, like you're saying, and you also have significant upside still, I mean, I think part of the appeal of Crabbe, right, is that he hasn't done it all the way yet. Like there's still more there for him. And you kind of want to get him in that sweet spot where you're getting him from ages 20, 24 to 27 on his next contract. And that's really when you want these guys right now. So I think it's setting up for him to get paid nicely. You know, if I'm the Blazers, you know, in terms of the priorities for this offseason, like, I mean, is the consensus like he's above Myers now on the totem pole in terms of priorities?
I mean, you talking about that, the injury, the surgery announcement for Myers Leonard that just came out late this week, he's going to be out for the season. You know, it was reported by Jason Quick from Comcast Sports that, you know, Myers said the plan is for there to be a 6 to 8 month rehab. It's going to be done with the Trailblazers, you know, strength and conditioning staff. He's going to go through with that. And he said he wants to be a Blazer next season. You know, I'm kind of curious about that because Myers Leonard, you know, for all we said about CJ McCollum stepping up in the playoffs last year and raising expectations for Blazer fans, I think the same could be said for Myers Leonard, his performance in the playoffs last year. Coming into this year, getting hurt, you know, what, 2 weeks into the season, losing his starting spot. You know, a lot of people expected that guy to step up and be a starter, you know, let alone be a guy who scored 15 points a game, shooting 40%, you know, from outside as a 7-footer. And that, you know, he was able to hit 3-pointers this year, but that's pretty much, you know, all he's been able to consistently do other than, ferociously grab open rebounds. There's really nothing else for Myers Leonard to hang his hat on this year. I'd have to consider this season, you know, if he was, you know, he said he was betting on himself when he declined that generous offer that the Blazers allegedly made this summer. I mean, that has to be a huge failure on his part in terms of betting on himself. I have no clue where this guy's value at. In fact, I was going to kind of ask you, you know, as someone who looks around the league and kind of knows, you know, what other teams kind of prioritize sometimes and where the league's going in terms of, you know, what kind of what they're looking for out of big men these days. You know, Myers Leonard has shown some flashes of being a good low post defender, a guy who can defend some of the marquee big men in the league. Again, I said flashes, and he's not particularly consistent at that. But on the offensive end, he's a guy who's a 7 foot who can stretch the floor. I mean, that's invaluable. So I don't know, Ben, do you look at this, you know, Myers Leonard, do you see him coming off this serious shoulder injury, maybe getting a reasonably sized offer from, you know, from a team like Atlanta or something?
I think he's going to get a reasonably sized offer from the Blazers. I think he's going to get, so first of all, you don't want to ever let an injury that happens right before the contract situation necessarily like influence when you're trying to commit either, you know, 4 or 5 year contract to a guy. You don't want the next, you know, the first 3 months of the very first year to be what you're basing the guy's value on, right? So you got to treat him like he's a healthy prospect, unless there's something like totally chronic with this injury where it's going to pop up again. So you got to be thinking about him as like a long-term asset. I mean, remember, there's a lot of costs involved with, number one, you used a lottery pick to get him. Number two, you spent multiple years trying to develop this guy, and that must have been a painstaking process, you know. God bless Kent Hughes. I mean, there's not enough money in the world to try to develop Myers Leonard. So, I mean, organizationally, you've spent all these things on him, right? So you want him to pan out for you. You don't want to develop him for somebody else. I think, you know, basically what you do if you're the Blazers is, you know, I what was the offer that was supposedly made, like 4 years, 48 or 40?
Yeah, it was roughly 12, 15 a year is what was reported.
So what I would expect to have happen is, if you're the Blazers, like, there's still a prove-it element to Myers Leonard. So maybe you're not getting the same length and the same kind of guarantees. Maybe there's more flexibility. Maybe it's a little bit shorter. But I think that same ballpark is going to be in play. Because remember back in, you know, a couple summers ago, you know, Channing Frye signs a 4-year, $32 million deal with the Orlando Magic. So if you just scale the cap up, you know, 32 becomes 40 or 42 pretty quickly when you're looking at, you know, where the total salary cap is going and sort of percentage wise on those deals. I mean, that contract proved to be tradable, you know, pretty quickly. So it wasn't like a drastic overpay, even though he did basically nothing in Orlando. So it's not like there's going to be this great fear of like, oh, we're going to sign Myers Leonard, we're going to be stuck with him. You know what I mean? Like, I think, and he's a lot younger than Frye was. At the time of that contract, and Frye, I remember, had some crazy things where, like, he missed a whole season with health-wise and, you know, the heart condition and all that. So there was a lot more red flags around Frye at that point of his career than there are about Myers right now. Maybe Frye was a little bit more proven, I get that, but I still think you're going to have teams totally interested in paying Myers a lot of money. And I also think the Blazers should continue to be interested in paying Myers a lot of money. And I think the big X factor is here, don't forget, he's Neil's guy. You know, so like, if you don't re-sign him, that's Neil basically like letting one of his guys walk out the door. And there's been a lot of people leaving the Blazers over the last few years, but not too many of Neil's guys have left. So I think that's a thing to consider as well.
You know, I mean, it's a little bit troubling, though, isn't it, that coming into this season, there was a lot of talk from the Blazers and from Myers himself about he wanted to embrace a leadership role. And part of that is consistency. And he hasn't shown anything to me this season that demonstrates that he's grown all that much. I mean, he got more minutes. He had a defined role, at least for a small part of the season, before he went back to the bench. I mean, to me, it doesn't look like he's done a ton to warrant the size of the contract the Blazers allegedly offered him last year. But I think the point you made about the fact that it's tradable, I think that the more I think about it, I think that that is probably what's going to be at play when the Blazers are determining his worth. Will not be necessarily how he's going to fit into the Blazers system moving forward. But I think a lot of teams are probably looking at a player like Myers Leonard and thinking that and this is something we talked, Chris, we talked on the podcast a couple weeks ago, that a change of scenery might be just what this player needs. And so as far as using as a bargaining chip for a trade, I think he could be quite valuable for the team.
Well, I think number one, the change of scenery situation, like, he should really appreciate Portland, you know, because they've really basically, in my opinion, I don't want to use this in like a pejorative way, but they've kind of babied him along, right? They've really taken a patient approach with him from day one. I mean, this is a guy who bought his own jersey at media day. You know, I watched him do it when he was a rookie. Like, he went into the fan shop, put his credit card down, and bought his own jersey right off the rack, right? So he was coming from a very interesting position as a rookie.
But did it fit?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully. Who knows who he was buying it for? Maybe his girlfriend or his mom or something. But so there was a lot of time invested in this, and I think there's still a chance he pans out. I mean, I understand he had a really bad year. You're just constantly hoping that the light bulb is going to come, and you really need it to come on defense if he's going to be the guy that you want him to be. I think also a reason why, if you're the Blazers, that you hang on to him is, what are your alternatives? I mean, are you going to get a player better than Myers Leonard for next season? Because remember, you're trying to win now. I mean, if you're the Blazers, you could talk yourself into being the fourth best team in the West next year, right? The Clippers are in shambles. All these other playoff teams are a mess. I mean, why not? Like, it's there. Damian's going to be better. CJ is going to be better. And these guys are entering their prime. So you want to put guys around them that can be impact guys. Are you going to get anybody in free agency who's not going to cost an arm and a leg, who's going to be better than Myers Leonard? To me, if you're the Blazers, that's real questionable. I mean, what are the big men they've been able to get in free agency over the years? It's like, let's bring back Joel Prisbilla and, you know, five times, you know, oh, now we found Chris Kamen on this, you know, whatever situation. It's like, these guys are, you know, not Myers Leonard comparable if you're looking at having Myers for the duration of his prime. And then I think also part of the issue is, like, their front court pieces are pretty weak, man. I watch these games. I don't really like any of these guys. I mean, my favorite guy on the whole team in terms of potential is Vonleh, but that guy's a ways away. Like, he's not going to be that number three guy next year. So, I mean, I think organizationally, priority-wise, if you just pay Myers, maybe you limit your total cost because he's able to give up a little bit on the back end of it, and you just hope for that breakout again next season. You continue to work him back to good health. You keep him in the family, quote unquote. I don't see the downside to doing that. And if it costs you a couple extra $1 million per year, okay.
Well, I'm going to parlay that into a question that we received from Paul Hawkins. And Paul, we appreciate the question. He asks, do you think the Blazers are going to pursue a third scorer in the offseason? And do you think that third scorer is going to be a post? And this is an interesting question. It relates to what we were just talking about. I mean, could Myers Leonard be that third scoring option the Blazers are looking for during the offseason, hoping that he does develop?
I haven't really dug into what I think the Blazers are going to do necessarily in a big time way this summer. But I think, just sort of generally speaking, if you're able to take one of your current pieces and turn them into what you want them to be, even if it's a gradual process that takes multiple years, if you're the Blazers and you're competing against all these teams that have crazy amounts of cap space this summer, that's going to be a much more feasible alternative than hoping and praying you're going to get a big name guy out in free agency. I also think if you're Portland, there's a little bit of the Dallas approach on offense at work here, where, you know, you've got your franchise guy in Dallas, it's Dirk. In Portland, it's Damian Lillard. You've got some supporting scorers who are reliable, guys like CJ and Crab. And then the rest of it is just kind of balanced, you know, like, you're getting contributions from 8, 9, 10 guys a night. And like, maybe a few of those guys are disappointing you at various nights. Maybe some other guys are, you know, kind of pleasantly surprising you on different nights, but you just have enough guys where you're kind of putting yourself in situations where you always have 4 or 5 scoring threats on the court. I don't know if I necessarily see Myers as like a number three guy solidified. But as we're seeing in Cleveland right now with Channing Frye, if Channing Frye is your fifth option and he's hitting his three-pointers, you're awesome. Your offense is freaking awesome. Like, really, really, really good, like, scary good. And so it's the same thing in Portland. To me, it's not the scoring with Myers. He's got to figure out how to be a center defensively in the NBA, period. Otherwise, you can't keep him on the court because he's lost. And I also don't see him as a four. I mean, that's another thing that we haven't really talked about. But to me, you know, playing him at the four, it's out of position for him. Just because now you're courting all these mismatch situations, it's just too easy to exploit defensively. So he's eventually going to have to figure out how to be a center defensively, or it's just not going to be worth it. And to me, if you're the Blazers and you had this really, really low payroll this year, you don't have tons of obligations in other situations next year, it's a reasonable proposition to bet on Meyer's ability to improve as a defensive player. And if it doesn't work out, well, okay, it didn't work out. Because I just don't think there's going to be a lot of other alternatives for them. Because, look, I mean, not only – there's another dynamic here that I haven't mentioned, but, like, not only do you have all these other teams who are going to be looking to make major splashes and peel off those top free agents who are going to be, like, the impact guys right off the top, but you also have a lot of stranded superstars around the league who are going to be looking at the Warriors and getting really fed up with them. Like, if the Warriors win the title again this year – I mean, you're already hearing it from LeBron. LeBron's chirping about it. But think about Carmelo Anthony. Like, how pointless is his life right now? look at Chris Paul. How frustrating is it to be Chris Paul right now? Look at Kevin Durant. You know, Kevin Durant is just seething. I mean, he was sick of being second 2 years ago. And now what? Now he's not even second. He's fourth. You know what I mean? Third. You just go right down the list. DeMarcus Cousins in Sacramento. John Wall in Washington. How many stranded Paul George in Indiana? How many stranded superstars are there right now? And are these guys going to figure out that if they consolidate, if they find ways to work trades and team up, now all of a sudden they're going to have a better chance to, you know, really challenge Golden State? So I think you're going to see a lot of craziness this summer. And historically, when summers are crazy, the Blazers aren't necessarily in on it. You know, so I think if you're Portland, just you're formula and your philosophy worked pretty well this year. Like, you overachieved. You're going to be in the playoffs unless something crazy happens. And there's a lot of other teams who are falling off the map a little bit in the Western Conference. You're positioned pretty well. I would just keep riding it.
So as you continue seeing these teams that, you know, may or may not just be kind of grabbing, you know, a nucleus of like two or three superstars together. I mean, you look at San Antonio has such a great team. They were able to get veteran after veteran for like, you know, $0. If there's a future in which you have like five or six teams that have, you know, a disproportionate amount of NBA talent, do you think that Adam Silver thinks about any type of like antitrust kind of anti-superstar glomming rule for the league to try to maintain parity? I've always wondered that. What do you think about that?
Well, I think number one, the history of the league has always been a top-down league. It's never been like a parity league. So that's not really necessarily anything new. And that's the funny thing. Like when I say big three, what do you guys think of? Miami, right?
Or Boston 2009.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. So a lot of people will say Miami, but they didn't invent that. That was Boston. You know what I mean? And then I think the Bulls fans would say, well, we had a big three. You know, it was Michael Scott.
And Boston before that.
You say, yeah. And then you just go right down the list. And so that's kind of always been that. The way to do it. I mean, why did the Blazers want, you know, Odin, LaMarcus, and Brandon Roy? It's the same principle. So I don't think that. Sorry, am I not allowed to say Greg Oden's name? Is that like a rule in this podcast?
No, there's a 15-year moratorium on that. And I think we're still in like year six, so he's got to hold off for a while.
Got it. Yeah. No. So, but in terms of what you're talking about with Adam Silver, I mean, he sort of tried to do that, right? Like, he drastically increased the luxury tax penalties. So that's making the cap a lot harder. I think that did influence spending for a lot of these teams in terms of not going crazy, crazy, crazy high above $100 million. I mean, only the idiots in Brooklyn and the really desperate people in Cleveland have really done that. Everybody else has pretty much played by the rules. So, you know, are they going to try to make the cap a little bit harder in this next one? Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all. I mean, it makes sense. But I think there's still ways to put these guys together. Sometimes it might require a little bit of sacrifice from the players. You know, like LeBron had to give a little back when he went to Miami, whatever it might be. But for the most part, you know, if you have enough room to pay 15 players, you have enough room to pay three guys really well and pay everybody else peanuts, you know?
You mentioned a little earlier on Terry Stotts, kind of coach of the year kind of talk. That's something that's been going around quite a bit at Blazers Edge. You know, and the listeners of this podcast probably know, you know, all of the reasons why Terry Stotts why Blazer fans would think Terry Stotts deserves to be in the conversation for Coach of the Year. Obviously, crazy, surprising team. What he's able to get out of, you know, what a lot of people would say limited players or limited role players, what he's able to squeeze out of, you know, for instance, you know, Gerald Henderson, Al-Farouq Aminu. I mean, these guys are having career years from behind the three-point line. I personally don't think that's any coincidence. I think most people would agree with me. That has a lot to do with Terry Stotts and his offense and the freedom that he gives players to pull the trigger when they have a wide open shot, and he puts them in a position to hit those kind of shots when they have them. So Blazer fans are intimately familiar with why we think Terry Stotts deserves, you know, some kind of a nod this year in terms of the national conversation for Coach of the Year. What I'm wondering from you, Ben, is this something realistic that the Blazers fans are talking about, or are there any other front runners around the league that really can make a better case for Coach of the Year than Terry Stotts?
Well, it does seem like he's kind of a media darling if you go by the names that get put out there on Twitter. I guess I'm a little tougher than some people. I don't like to give medals and team awards if you're 500. You know, you have to do a little better than that. So if they close really strong here with this home heavy schedule, and they're getting up to, like, you know, I don't know, mid-40s and wins or something, whatever they could basically get if they run the table, then all of a sudden I think that's a conversation. But, like, 37 and 36, even if you beat expectations by 10, 12, 14 wins, whatever it would be, I mean, look at all these other teams that have done similar things. You've got Charlotte right now. You've got Indiana. I mentioned Detroit before. You know, Miami to me has done an amazing job given the injury issues. You got Boston. I would make a pretty strong case for Dwayne Casey in Toronto. You can always put Popovich and Kerr in these conversations. You know, Dave Yeager, I think you could say everything you can basically say about Terry Stotts, you could say about Dave Yeager in Memphis, and he's got a better record, and he's had way more injury issues to get to work around and to deal with. So I think Terry Stotts is a candidate. I just don't think he would be one of my top three candidates at this point unless they finish the season really, really strong. But also keep in mind, like, coming into the season, I had the Blazers third in the Northwest. I had them behind the Jazz but ahead of the Nuggets and the Timberwolves. Looks like they're going to beat the Jazz unless something kind of kooky happens, like Jazz, you know, Utah makes a really strong late push, and they haven't been playing that great, so I don't necessarily see that happening. So I'm not really in that camp that's like, oh my God, like Portland totally blew away expectations. Like, they've definitely been better than I thought they would. But part of that too is that the West has been pretty weak. Like, if they were the number six seed in last year's Western Conference or 2 years ago Western Conference, I'd be more impressed. But to me, it's been a three-team conference all year long. I don't trust the Clippers. I don't trust the Grizzlies. I don't trust the Rockets, the Mavericks, the Jazz. I mean, all those teams have kind of been disappointing in one way or another. So, I don't know. I mean, sorry to burst everybody's bubble. I think he's going to get a lot of votes. I think he could easily finish in the top three. To me, I would be looking at a guy like Dwayne Casey because he had a lot of changes on his roster. I mean, you look at, like, Biyombo, Corey Joseph. They had to deal with Valanciunas being out. So lots of changes there, and yet he's got them, you know, almost within spitting distance of the number one seed in the Eastern Conference. And also, he's doing that in a hot seat year, by the way. Like, this is his last guaranteed year of his contract. So to, you know, have a first franchise's first 50-win season, which they're going to do, I think to me that's something that you reward. And if you don't like that, then I think you look at the Celtics and you say, well, pretty much everything you've just said about the Blazers could be applied to the Celtics too. And then you got to look at Brad Stevens. And, oh, by the way, we have two teams that might win 70 games. Their coaches probably did a pretty good job as well. So I don't know. I get the argument for Terry Stotts. I just don't love it.
So just to fold in another question here related to what we're talking about, this is coming off Twitter from Lance Carmalt, and he asks, and I mean, just for some context, you were saying that perhaps Terry Stotts would get a little more attention from you on your ballot if the Blazers were to make a run to end the year, improve their playoff positioning. So Lance asks, do you think the Blazers can dial in and focus for this last stretch and for the playoffs the way that they did in February?
Yeah, well, I kind of anticipated the slippage, and I actually thought they were going to slip a little bit harder than they did on those road trips in March. That being said, they didn't guard anybody for the whole month. I mean, some of the point totals, like,
oh,
I went
man.
to like I went to Death Valley and it was like Death Valley temperature point totals. It's like, we're going to 110. Oh no, we're up to 120. No, hey, it's 132 against the Mavericks. Oh, okay. And you're making Dirk Nowitzki look like he got into a time machine 10 years ago. You know what I mean? Like, ugh, bad. But, you know, I saw him last night down here in LA against the Clippers, and you know, they didn't play that well offensively, but I thought they showed a pretty good resolve. I mean, they're definitely playing hard. I mean, you got to give them credit for that. I think that goes a long way. And then they're going to be back at home, and I think there's going to be some of these teams they're playing. You know, you don't have a lot to play for. And so when you're getting them at, you know, you're at home, those are going to be wins for you. So I think they're going to be able to get in the playoffs. I don't see them catching Memphis. I know some people were like really hoping that that was going to be an outside chance. I don't see that. But I think that they're in a better position right now than the Rockets. Dallas is really trying to keep it together. I mean, Chandler Parsons thing is pretty rough for them. So if I had to wager money on it right now, I would say they'd be the sixth seed. And I would say they're probably going to be out in five games to the Thunder in the first round.
All right. So on that note, I think that's plenty of hardcore Blazer talk, because it's not every day we get a guy on the show who worked for Blazers Edge for, what was it, 7 years, you know, back in the day. So, Ben, I want to ask you a few questions before we get off here about your time covering the Blazers with Blazers Edge and what you've been doing since. So I guess, first off, I remember personally, before I even started reading BlazersEdge.com regularly, I stumbled upon a blog in the summer of 2007 called Draft Kevin Durant. And that's what originally brought me to Blazers Edge, because I think Dave either linked to it or he published it on Blazers Edge. And so what I wanted to ask you was, you know, what was that kind of experience like back in the summer of 2007? Were you just a young freelancer just trying to get your name out there? And how did things kind of fall into place with you getting on at Blazers Edge?
Well, first of all, you must have been a real degenerate if you were able to find Draft Kevin Durant, because I don't know how many people were reading that. but so here's what happened. This is an honest to God true story. It's kind of a lightning strike moment. So I was working in Tigard at a marketing firm. You know, I was like a brand manager for a, you know, they made products, but we also just kind of sold them online, like an e-retailer kind of thing. So it was your typical 9 to 5, although I was working pretty long hours. So it was more like an, I don't know, 7:30 to 7 type of thing, where it's just kind of like small startup and really pushing pretty hard. But for whatever reason, you know, I've always been a basketball fan. I'm from Portland. So I was really interested in the draft lottery, of course. So I went home from work early that day and watched the draft lottery, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, I'm sitting there shocked, jumping up and down like everybody else. Like, this is like this life-changing moment for this franchise. Like, this is about to embark, you know, open up this 10-year window of, you know, potential championships. You know, it's kind of like the sky was the limit in that moment. So within, I think, an hour of them winning the lottery, I had already gone to Blogspot and registered draftkevindurant.blogspot.com. And I was like furiously typing up like the first post. Like, I mean, I put so much dumb crap on there. Like, I had, you know, comparisons of like Kevin Durant to like a baby elephant, like all these different things. I don't watch a lot of college basketball, but I just remember him as like a prospect of just being like this guy who just like completely, you know, just completely had the it quality. And then also you would hear these stories about like him sleeping in the gym when he was like 12 years old, because, you know, he had worked himself to exhaustion, but he didn't want to go home. He just wanted to like wake up after he was sleeping and, you know, play some more. And I was also kind of coming at it from a kind of a practical standpoint, like for the Blazers organization, where I was like, this guy is so freaking marketable. Like, you know, you've had all these tough times in the past. You're not really drawing a lot of fans, even though there's like the young pieces are kind of coming together in place. You need this jolt of like the it factor and somebody who everybody can rally around. And I just really felt pretty strongly that this was the guy. Like, he had the personality to do it. And I know a lot of people felt that way about Odin, because they thought he was really funny and he had a good sense of humor. But to me, the personality was always for Durant. I thought, you know, things like shoes, you know, I thought he'd be able to sell a lot of shoes, and some people think that's not that important, but like, you know, that matters. You know, I mean, what are we talking about this week? It's like Curry versus, you know, Nike versus Under Armour over Curry's deal. You know, is LeBron comfortable, you know, with Curry? And then, oh, now all of a sudden Ben Simmons is at the Cavaliers game, but he's wearing Yeezys. He's not wearing Nike. So, like, what does that mean for his contract? I mean, like, the sneaker stuff matters. Like, people don't think it does, but it does. So I thought, okay, well, here's a guy who can sell sneakers. He's going to sell tons of jerseys. He's going to be a great face of the franchise. I thought he could fit pretty cleanly between Roy and Aldridge as sort of like your 2-3-4. And I thought with Aldridge and Durant, that's just so much length that I thought that it would just give teams so much trouble and it would be an automatic, like, from day one identity. So for all these reasons, I was like way, way in on Kevin Durant. And also I was like delusional. Like, I was convinced that if I just wrote every single night, I could like write it into existence. Like, I would just be able to like make it happen. You know what I mean? So from that standpoint, I was probably a lot like these Trump supporters, but just kidding. So I started writing. I'd go to work. And then in my day job, I'd come home and I'd write for like 3, 4, 5 hours every single night, whatever goofy stuff I could come up with. And I was doing a lot of aggregation, whatever, just putting it together. And I was really aggressively like spamming every website with my links. Like, I was like, Deadspin, here's this, True Hoop, Henry Abbott, like, read this. And I had all sorts of crazy things. But the big stunt that kind of got me noticed was like right before the draft, I wrote like a college term paper, like laying out my argument. It was like, I want to say like 16 pages long, but it was like footnoted citations. Like, here's all the reasons why they should do this. And I mean, obviously no one is dumb enough to do that today, but there was like, nobody was definitely dumb enough to do that back then, you know? So it was like this thing where it was like, who the hell is this guy doing this? So I think that kind of got helped me noticed by like some of the national sites and the like influential bloggers and whatever. But it was all just like, you know, a lark. I mean, I had no big grandmaster plan with it. I was convinced it was going to happen. I've got a great picture of me. I went to this bar restaurant in Garden Home, you know, Southwest Portland, and I'm watching the draft, and I'm still watching it thinking that they're going to listen to me and taking Durant, even though they've already basically leaked that they're going to take Oden multiple times. I'm completely convinced they're going to do it. And so there's this picture of me once they announce, like, Odin's getting like the introduction with Stern in the background. And then I'm just like sitting there crestfallen with my hand in my head, or my head in my hand, just like, oh my God, why did they do this? So it was a funny ride. But then I woke up the next morning and I was like, well, guess what? Like, you can't have a website called Draft Kevin Durant when they didn't draft Kevin Durant. Like, you got to figure out what's next. And so I emailed all these people, what's next, what's next? And nobody really had a good answer for me. They're just like, dude, you're the crazy guy who wrote about Kevin Durant. Like, good job. Like, we'll talk to you never. You know what I mean? Like, and you see a lot of the flash in the pan stuff happen online. So I just kind of went back to work and was doing my own thing for a while. And I think, you know, at that point, Dave was trying to figure out how to kind of build the site up even more. And obviously he was geographically not in a position to like go attend a lot of games. And so for me, the appeal of starting at Blazers Edge was like, well, you know, I was a season ticket holder, like a quarter season ticket holder for the previous season. So this was a way for me to go to games for free, number one. Number two, it was a way to write. And I went to college for writing and I really liked writing and I didn't know what the hell I was doing, but it was like, pfft. So I get a free ticket and I get a write. So that's kind of cool. And then number three, it was like, well, I could kind of do it like moonlighting. Like, there was no pressure. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't like, oh, you have these amazing deadlines and like you have all this pressure, like breaking news. Like, it was just kind of a fun experiment. And so when I started at Blazers Edge in December 2007, I had no like grand plan of like, okay, I'm going to take this, I'm going to turn it into something else. It was just like, this is fun to do, so I'll do it. And I just kind of kept doing it and kept doing it. And then at one point we ramped up and I started going to practices a little bit more. And then I kind of got the summer league bug. So I went down and covered summer league. And just the more that I did it, the more I enjoyed it. So I just kept doing it. And it was pretty simple. And a lot of times I'll get people who are like in college right now or whatever. And they're like, so how do I like write for, you know, Sports Illustrated? How do I like write about sports? And I was like, dude, you could try to do what I did, but like, you'd never be able to replicate it in a million years. And I don't mean that in like a bragging way. I just mean that in like, my path was like totally insane and I got really, really, really lucky. So, you know, don't turn to me for advice. Just work really hard and hope things work out, basically.
Oh, it's amazing to look back and think that that's only 9 years ago, how much the media landscape has changed, really. But, you know, I remember before I was a staff member at Blazers Edge, and even the year where I worked under you at Blazers Edge, I remember your media row reports for the home game. So you'd go and cover every home game. Now, one thing I thought was pretty cool, and I think fans thought was pretty cool, was you covered a lot of the players' shoes, what they were wearing, which was pretty cool. So I wanted to ask you kind of, first off, what was kind of your thought behind that? And second, like, I remember I'd have to wait up till like 2:30, 3 in the morning sometimes after, you know, even after Dave's analysis was up, I read that and then wait till 2:30 or 3 for your media row report to come up. So was that like, were you also working at the same time as that? Were you, so you were going to Blazer games, watching the game, going and getting quotes, going home, writing up your story, publishing it at 3 in the morning, and then waking up and going to work at 7 o'clock the next day?
So, you know, you're remembering when the media row reports were actually good. That's when they would take until 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning to do it. So for the first couple of years, they weren't good, and I was not staying up that late. And there was one summer where Dave wrote a really nice note, and I think he called me like the most improved player or something like that, where he said something like, I'd finally taken my game up, you know, and not, now he didn't say finally, like it was actually a nice note. It wasn't condescending, like I just made it sound, but he's like, yeah, you know, Ben's kind of come along. And it took me a few years to kind of get my groove for sure. And those first couple of years, when I was working, there was a time crunch. It was like, well, I got to be to bed by like 1 o'clock probably. Otherwise, I'm not going to be able to be up and be functional. I mean, the one benefit, though, is I'm only doing home games, right? So, like, if they're on the road trip and, you know, the Blazers go on these 2-week road trips, well, like, I'm at work for 2.5 weeks every single night, and I can crank and get ahead on projects and do whatever I need to do. And when they're home, you know, then I got to work around it. But then there's also weekend games, too, you know? So there's only, you know, on the course of any given month, there would probably only be like 4 or 5 of the weeknight home games where like you'd have those ugly turnarounds. Otherwise, you know, it's really not that bad. And usually they'd be spread out. So, you know, it just kind of made it work. You know, I started at CBS in 2010. And so by that point, I was kind of in position where just basketball writing was like my whole life. Like that's all I was doing. So staying up until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning was like, you know, not a big deal. And there was actually sometimes the first year at CBS where like, not only was I staying up till 2 or 3, but like I would have shifts that would start at 5 a.m. because they would start 8 o'clock Eastern. So there was like some times where like, oh man, I was not sleeping very much at all. But I think if you talk to a lot of people who have like made it in the media industry, like they'll tell you like, you know, it's going to take like 2, 3, or 4 years of just grinding around the clock constantly to get noticed, to get the reputation out there, to kind of get established. And so, you know, as I was getting deeper into it, and as I was, I mean, the media reports were a lot of work, but they were also at the same time, like no work at all, you know, because it was like my favorite thing to do. Like if there would be nothing else in the world I'd rather do than write a media row report. It's like, let's go like get this, the craziest quotes that we can get from the locker room and painstakingly put them together. And then part of my process, which people probably don't know, but like I would, maybe they don't care, I'm not sure who would, but maybe you guys do, hopefully, is that like I would transcribe all the quotes at the arena, and then I would drive home, and I had about a 25-minute drive home. And so I would start to like formulate my leads and like figure out how I wanted to piece everything together on that ride home. And it's almost something that I, like, if there were no deadlines, I would tell everybody to do that. Just like completely distance yourself from what you just witnessed and just think about it. Like, don't race into the running. Just like think about what you want to write about. Think about what it compares to in your real life or outside of basketball. Like, how do you want to present this? What's the big takeaway? And then I would get home and just bang it out, you know, much more quickly and pretty efficiently. So, yeah, but I mean, there was a lot of long days, lots of short nights. You know, I put a lot of weight on, you know, people don't realize that too. Like it's hard to take care of yourself when you're working that much. So, I mean, that was part of it too, whereas like, as soon as I had the flexibility schedule wise to like, maybe not be doing quite as much as I was doing, like the first thing I did was like, let's just try to take this weight back off. Like, let's try to get to a healthier place. But I'd always joke about the Red Bulls. I'm sure you guys remember that in the media row reports. Like those were not jokes. Like I was just slugging those things constantly. Still do. So yeah, I don't know if did that answer your question basically, but
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, and thinking about, I mean, what you're saying, when you're saying earlier, you know, obviously trying to get good quotes from the locker room, and you, me, and Chris were talking before the podcast about the dynamic that reporters have. I mean, part of your job is to, I would imagine, correct me if I'm wrong, to ingratiate yourself with the players and with the teams so that they're more comfortable talking to you, so they're willing to talk to you. But then the other half of that balance is that you do want to report the interesting things that you hear, the things that you think are going to, you know, perk people's ears up. And I'm just curious, how was it managing that balance for you between trying to make sure that you're staying in people's good graces, but also getting the readers what they actually wanted to read?
Yeah. So for me, I was never trying to make friends. Like, I just kind of came at it from that perspective. And I felt like I had a luxury doing that because Blazers Edge was the outsiders, you know, like, I mean, you guys kind of know from my style, like I kind of go for the throat, you know, like when I'm writing, like I'm not trying to use euphemisms and like beat around the bush. Like I'm just trying to keep it real. And if I have to be really harsh and cold towards a player about their ability, like I think actually on a podcast this week, I said that Northern Iowa, like that meltdown reminded me of like third graders basketball. Like if I wanted to watch that, I would just go volunteer like my local elementary school. Like that's a little bit over the top, but like, yeah, guess what? No one on Northern Iowa now wants to be my best friend because I said that, you know what I mean? Like there is definitely a trade-off there. But for me, when I first started Blazers Edge, because I didn't come from a journalism background. I've never taken a journalism class in my life. I've spoken to journalism students, like I've talked to them, but like I'm like asking them questions, like, you know, I don't have any formal training for that whatsoever. I mean, my classes were fiction, poetry, and nonfiction writing. So I mean, I'm sitting around in the very stereotypical, and I'm in college, it's like very stereotypical like writers groups where like we're on a lawn with our legs crossed, and you know, we're talking about like which poet this reminds us of, you know, like, oh, it's a little bit too much like Yeats, you know, like whatever, like that kind of thing. There's no like who, what, when, like here's how you do it. So that's kind of how I came at it. Like, and my whole plan when I started was I'm going to be a fly on the wall. I'm going to write this like I was basically taught to write nonfiction, where just like use all of your senses, but don't be actively involved in it. And so just kind of like take this detached approach. And eventually I realized like a lot of the quotes that were getting said or a lot of the interviews that were being done were very rote and very routine. And like, if I didn't ever interject with whatever I wanted to know or like whatever angle I wanted to pursue, then I wasn't going to be able to get the stuff that was most interesting to me. So I kind of pick and choose my spots a little bit. I also think like one thing I do think I have, is I think I have a pretty good ear for news. Like if I'm in a scrum and it lasts for 5 minutes, when I leave that scrum, and this is something that I think I had pretty early, I could tell you exactly what the headline would be from that scrum, like quickly. And not only like the news headline, but like what would play on the internet. And because I was only coming at this from an internet perspective, right? So like the Raymond Felton thing about, you know, I'm going to keep it 100, like, you know, I'm going to invite people to the Indigo. Like when he told me that, and like they're like quick, and these other guys, they can attest, like when I went back to the media room, I was freaking giggling because I knew this was going to be the story for the next 4 days. You know what I mean? When I took that photo of Felton with the cupcake, it was like, I didn't totally realize the magic I had when I took that picture, but people still send that to me. How many years has that been? He's played for like half the league since that photo, and people still come at me about that.
Was that
you, Ben, who got the that really unflattering photo of Chris McGowan that we used a lot on the front page?
Yeah, so I didn't realize everybody hated that photo so much. It was just from his introductory press conference, or maybe it was from earlier in his career. He just looked really young, and so I think that was part of the issue. And you know, he came in pretty untested. And then his first press conference, you know, it was just one of those situations where like he just needed a mulligan. Like the PR people just needed to tell him, like, look, dude, that wasn't good. Like, we're just going to try again tomorrow. And I think that probably would have been unorthodox, but would have been a better, you know, setup for him. But you got to give him a lot of credit. I mean, he's really come a long way as an executive, grown into the role, you know, had a lot of fan friendly changes. And, you know, I hear a lot about people, just even simple things like the food at the arena. Stuff like that has gotten through to people. You know, the naming rights deal obviously, you know, sparked a huge backlash, but that put the team in a better place financially. So, yeah, it wasn't like people think I maybe some people think I had like malintentions with that, or I was like trying to like, you know, be a huge jerk about it, but that really wasn't the case. And then same thing with that Felton picture. It just kind of became iconic and had a life of its own. And we were just talking before we came on here about like the one time we put five Felton pictures side by side for his first, yeah. you know, his first comeback game against, you know, when it was like the Knicks versus the Blazers. And part of that, it wasn't like to mock him, but each one of those pictures was corresponding to like more quotes that he had said negative about Portland or about the local media or about the team, you know, decision making or whatever. And so the idea with all those pictures side by side was to kind of reflect how much he was fueling this sort of like two-way antipathy. And honestly, the post-game locker room press conference after that game was really charged. I mean, he refused to answer questions from one local media member, you know, just basically pretended like he wasn't even there. I was asking him how it felt to, you know, basically get booed relentlessly throughout the course of that game. And he had some pretty sort of braggadocious or confident type of quotes about it. So usually there was a method to the madness. The McGowan one, I don't totally remember why we used that photo. I think just because we couldn't find any other ones online. But what's funny is, do you remember, you know, Dwayne Hankins, the marketing manager who got hired, who was like McGowan's understudy and still sort of is, we had found some really goofy picture of him. I forget exactly what he was doing, but it was some like totally off the wall goofy picture. And he emailed me as soon as the first time we used it. He was like, dude, thanks for finding that picture. That's awesome. That's hilarious. So like sometimes very important people can have a sense of humor about the pictures that maybe the average fan or the reader wouldn't expect. But you know, I understand it. I'm pretty careful with my own image. I mean, I've had the same Twitter avatar probably for 5 years. I look nothing like my picture. You know, I've aged quite a bit. So I understand why people might be sensitive about that, but we didn't mean any harm with that picture.
There you go, Chris McGowan. If you're listening, we can straighten that out.
Chris McGowan also was very friendly and gave me tons of time for a Portland Business Journal article I did on him a few years ago. So as far as I know, we're on good terms. I saw him in December, I think. I think I said hi to him. So don't worry. It's not like we have a big cold war over the picture that we used on Blazers Edge in 2011.
No beef there. I got. I think one last question to ask you before we get out of here. And you don't have to answer the second half of this one. I'll let you plead the fifth if you need to. But you know, in your time covering the Blazers and being in the locker room and getting to know the personalities and the players and the coaches and the front office, you know, the first part of the question is who was your favorite guy, or who were some of your favorite guys to talk to post game, after practices, get quotes from? And on the flip side of that, if you're willing to share, were there any guys that weren't as fun to talk to when you were covering the Blazers?
Well, so again, kind of keep in mind like my general philosophy. Like I wasn't trying to be upfront asking questions of every single guy, like constantly, like that's some guys' jobs. And part of what I did in my role, because I wasn't on deadline, is I would a lot of times purposefully defer to the beat guys, because if they needed a quote, like you're running for the Associated Press or whatever, and you got to have that in half an hour before the game. Like the last thing you do want is somebody like me asking four questions about offense or rebounding or like some obscure thing that's like never going to make the game story. You know what I mean? So like that was kind of part of my approach, where I don't think I had as many one-on-one interactions with guys as a lot of other writers who kind of do my job. But again, to me, that was sort of like philosophical. Like that's kind of how I wanted it to be. If I'm doing a big profile on a guy, obviously that's going to be different. But just in general, I mean, my favorite guy to interview, to talk to be around ever was Brandon Roy for the Blazers, no question about it. A big part of that, and this is going to sound kind of like a star effer, you know what I mean? Like the swear word that I can't say. But I think a huge avenue or aspect that fans might not get if you're not there is that almost always people who are famous and really, really, really good at basketball are going to be inherently more interesting than people who aren't. You know what I mean? Like you could have the most amazing story. Like remember Chris Johnson? He was like in a gunfight in Puerto Rico during summer of the lockout or something like that. And so like I had that insane story. You know, he's basically dodging bullets before he's coming back to play for the Blazers. that is a crazy freaking story, you know? But like, how many people care about that story? Or if it was LeBron in the exact same situation, you know, which one is leading every media network? You know, it's not even close. And so part of that, that's part of the challenge when you're a writer is, okay, well, these are the famous guys. How do you get something that nobody else has gotten out of them? How do you have a unique angle? How can you kind of mine, you know, repeatedly mine territory to get something new and fresh and to have it work in your story? And so the biggest star when I was in Portland by far was Brandon Roy. And I think there was a couple situations where I was able to kind of get quotes from him that I was really proud of. Like there was one after one of his first game winners where I got him to kind of reflect on what it means to be clutch, or like his view of what being clutch is about. And so, you know, you walk away from that interview and you're just like, man, like this is amazing. Like this guy's an all-star, all-NBA type player. You know, he just gave me this like soliloquy on being clutch, which is like obviously a big topic. And so, you know, that's out of the ordinary. And so you kind of remember those things. Whereas, you know, if you ask a guy, like just insert random replacement, you know, backup player, you know, it's not as interesting. You know, I even like LaMarcus Aldridge, and he gets a terrible rap from other media members. But I do remember when I was like prodding him about like him versus Kevin Love and like, you know, who should be on the All-Star team starters that year. And, you know, and he was kind of like making the case for why he was like overlooked and just kind of getting some quotes at him from stuff like that. Like if you could kind of read between the lines, and I thought I did an okay job when I was writing it to try to get across what he meant by that, you could kind of see how much these things meant to him and how competitive he actually was, even if he wasn't willing to just kind of come out and say it. And so to me, you know, I respected him a lot for that. And also he's a big time player. And so he was always interesting to me. You know, Nicholas Batum's another one. You know, sometimes things got lost in translation a little bit, or maybe it was a little tricky, especially early in his career, but he was pretty interesting. To me, the worst player, period, in the Blazers from my time period, it wasn't a guy you would think. It was Greg Oden, because the guy hid from the media for years, you know? And once you have to start relying on guys for quotes and you see them in the workout room, you know, right over there, and it's part of the team strategy that these guys just don't talk, and he's not willing to overrule that team strategy and just come out and tell us how he's doing, where he's at, what's his plan, whatever. It's just endlessly frustrating, and I think it built up. You saw some reporters lash out a little bit. You know, there's a columnist in Portland, and I'm sure you guys know, who, you know, kind of basically just started going at Greg. You know, it's almost sort of just to be like, look, we're going to come at you and see if you're ever going to respond and like stand up for yourself. But the one really good one-on-one interview I had with Greg Oden, we were at, what's the name of that place? It's up in Vancouver. It's like a bowling alley. Plus they've got the big screen. Oh, Big Al's. So we're in the birthday party room at Big Al's, and he's in like a little children's like plastic chair. So his knees are up basically like level with his eyes because he's like crammed into one of these little like children's chairs in the birthday party room of Big Al's. And we're one-on-one talking for 10, 15 minutes. It was the only genuine interaction I ever had with him during his entire tenure in Portland. How many stories do you think I wrote about Greg Oden during his time period? 500, you know, yeah. I mean, 400, so many. And throughout that entire time period, I got one good one-on-one interview with him. And so to me, that was really frustrating. I thought he was so good in that interview. It was just great. But it's like, where's this guy been for 5 years? And so that's been, that part really always left me with kind of a sour taste in my mouth. Because I was totally, because people will think, oh, you just hate Greg Oden because you wanted Kevin Durant. But you have to realize from my perspective, I never wanted to be the guy who was running around telling everybody constantly how right that I was, because that's just, you're just a jack blank, you know, like you're just, you know, a blank hole or whatever, you know, phrase you want to use.
Keeping a Blazer's edge safe. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm trying. Like that's how you would feel if you were constantly doing that, right? So once he missed his rookie year, I kind of had to think about it philosophically again and just be like, look, how are you going to approach Greg Oden? And I was like, look, I'm going to try to give this guy every benefit of the doubt. I'm not going to try to be too harsh on him. Let's just see where it goes. And then ultimately, it came to a point contractually where they had to make a decision on it. And I came out pretty hard saying they should just part ways with him. But that was all carefully reported about what was the condition of his knees at that point. How was the team kind of being held up by him? How did the other players feel about it? what kind of a bind. I mean, it was really just putting the whole team in purgatory, having them there, you know what I mean? And so I thought they should have cut ties with him a year before they did. But I thought I came to that conclusion fairly. I don't think I was being rash. And I think ultimately the way everything played out afterwards kind of justified what my take was. So he would be on that list. Another tough guy was Gerald Wallace. You know, sometimes he had a great voice. He just didn't want to. He just didn't want to really talk to the media. So I think that was another guy who was pretty tough. I'm trying to think of some other ones. Who else gets mentioned when you guys ask these? You know, ask other people these questions.
I mean, I feel like the first guy comes to mind. Didn't play for the Blazers, but Jerry Stackhouse for sure.
Oh yeah, yeah. I can't say I've had any real interactions with him. Although I think he's an assistant coach. I want to say with Toronto right now. So I think he's probably. You know, another guy who was really annoying was Rudy Fernandez. Oh, God.
Oh, really?
He's so famous in Spain, and he was so, like, wasn't really famous in Portland. Like, he was very popular when he first came, and then he kind of became a little bit of a lightning rod. And he was just never happy. It just wasn't a good fit for him. He came to the wrong city, I think the wrong team, whatever. And so he was very moody. I think for a while we were calling him Moody Fernandez. And so he was just a tough guy to get anything out of. And you didn't like you also kind of felt like you couldn't trust him a little bit. Like, you know, remember that whole fiasco? Is he going to show up to media day? Is he not going to show up to media day? And he changed the story like 4 times and he eventually showed up. It's like, dude, this isn't kindergarten. You know, it's the first day of school. Just show up. Take your picture. It's not really that difficult. If Markieff Morris can do it in Phoenix this year, you know, Rudy Fernandez can do it. So I think those are some of the guys. I think I answered it without throwing anybody totally under the bus.
Well, one more I wanted to throw out there that you hear wasn't super awesome to deal with. Wanted to get your take on it. Robin Lopez.
Yeah, he was pretty strange. Just kind of curt. I mean, to me, if a guy has, I don't want to say like, you know, social anxiety or like there's something like going on personality wise, again, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. And he clearly was not comfortable. Like when people would crowd around his locker, he would get like noticeably uncomfortable, like basically telling people to back up, get out of his space, whatever. And a lot of guys, you know, like Steph Curry, he gets completely swallowed by like 80 reporters now, and he's okay with it just because his personality makes him okay with it. So I'm not really going to hold that against the Robin Lopez. I never thought he gave very good quotes or offered much insight in his post-game comments. I think he looked at it as an obligation. And I think also he's part of the idea of the changing media landscape where he realized like he could put his own personality out there on Twitter and in these like funny videos or in his cartoons or like however he wanted to do it. Like he could connect with fans. He didn't need the media necessarily as like the in-between or the go-between. And so he found ways to kind of become a fan favorite, kind of bypassing the traditional channels. And some media members would react really negatively to that and say, well, you know, this guy's basically, you know, kind of getting over on us. And, you know, he owes us something a little bit better than that. Because I only have written really online, occasionally in magazines, but I started online, I tend to give those guys more leeway with that. And I get it. And, you know, the younger these players are, the more they've grown up on social media and spent a lot of time there. If that's where they're comfortable expressing themselves, that's where we've got to go learn about them. You can't just expect that they're going to like flash the charm for you because you're a writer. It's just not how it works.
Ben, so I'd be surprised personally if anybody listening to this isn't following you on Twitter and knows what you're up to. But just in case anyone's uninformed on that, do you want to give Blazers Edge listeners an idea of where they can find your work online?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter. It's at Ben Golliver, BenGolliver. You can also follow our Sports Illustrated NBA account. It's SI_NBA. The SI accounts, SI Now, SINOW. I think we got a Facebook page now. The other thing I would say, like, we also have this new podcast called Open Floor. So if anybody's still listening to this and has listened to the podcast or wants to check it out, do that. And if you can, like, give us, you know, just, like, totally stack the deck, give us a 5-star rating, give us, like, a positive, give us a positive review, like, throw us a few bones, that'd be great. Because we just started it. We're kind of, like, in launch mode right now. But that's been pretty fun. people can check out. We got a Facebook page now. Facebook, just go Sports Illustrated NBA on Facebook. I'm not on Snapchat. Not on Instagram. I think that's pretty much how you can do it.
Sweet, man. I really appreciate you being so gracious with your time and coming back to Blazers Edge and answering a bunch of questions for us. So maybe we'll have you back in the future. Maybe we'll have you back sometime in the offseason and we'll talk more just kind of general NBA stuff, Blazers Edge stuff. But yeah, you're welcome back anytime and I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, guys. It was great chatting. Stay out of trouble.
Thanks, man. Yeah. Alrighty, we're now done with episode 123 of the Blazers Edge podcast. I'd like to thank you for joining us this week. And I'd also like to give a huge thank you to former Blazers Edge editor and current SI.com writer Ben Golliver for coming on the show. That was super fun this week.
Yeah, that was super dope. And equally dope is our intro and outro music brought to you by Odar. You can check out his work at soundcloud.com/OdarBeats. Check out the Blazers Edge midweek podcast with Dave Deckard and Phil Masons. For Chris Lucia, I'm Brandon Goldner. Remember to say your prayers and take your vitamins.